A Chorus of Ears, written and read by Denise Riley, with a foreword written and read by Don Patterson. In fond memory of Alice Notley, quote, "But I have to sing this song, I'm still here." And for dear beleaguered friends in America.
Forward. A Chorus of Ears is too rich a book to adequately praise. One can only say what one has taken away. The author has chosen her words with a kind of demonic care that demands an equivalent attention. I can't recall the last time I was so afraid I'd miss a word, nor when I was last so ear-punchingly thrilled by what I was reading, in this case the superb articulation of correctives long overdue. Readers, I suspect, will find it hard to think about poets in quite the same way again, but it will be harder for many poets to resist immediately trying to adopt their own practice in the light of what Riley proposes. No statement on poetry has excited me so much since Heaney's The Government of the Tongue. Riley herself stands at the end of a short line of poets from the modern era, from Unamuno to Paz by way of Valerie, Eliot and Stevens, whom one could also call serious thinkers, and with whose work this little bomb of a book stands comparison. Riley has circled its territory before, especially in The Words of Selves, but A Chorus of Ears distills, I think, the most urgent lesson she has for us. The book comprises four essays. The first lays out an extraordinary argument for poetry as a kind of compulsive inner performance. The truest lyric practice, Riley says, demands an impersonal, language-driven life that's independent of the poet's public persona, especially those self-limiting ideas of marketability that the contemporary poetry machine everywhere incentivizes. The second essay draws on Schlegel, Mill, Schiller, Schelling, Eliot, Foucault, Jack Spicer and Fanny Howe to develop the idea of what Riley calls a transpersonal mode related to Peter Gizzi's idea of the impersonal personal. This advocates a way of writing poetry as a form of self-overhearing, a cure for the kind of self-consciousness guaranteed to tame the poem and limit its ability to make new and to make strange. The third essay describes the poem as naturally bodied forth from the interplay of all our inner voices, of our ghosts, literary and otherwise, while also given rise to by the prosody of language itself. In the final essay, Riley describes how the lyric voice circulates between writer and reader, existing as audiation, a word I only knew in a musical context, but it means something like the inner hearing of music in the absence of any actual music. Poets might hear lyric in much the same way, in a space of mobile self-animation where the attending ear can provoke the rapid evolution of spoken thought. It's in this whirl that we might find ourselves suddenly capable of the kind of self-surprise and intelligent intuition we manage when on our best form, improvising our speech before a keenly listening audience. That old heresy we can trace from Pope to Jacobson that sound and sense are the same thing for poets. Must have, if it's to be taken literally, the possible consequence that the ear can sometimes take the lead and draw the mind forward as it leans in. But what I take away most powerfully is a sharply updated definition of the old and fashionable idea of poetic inspiration. Along the way, Riley offers some deliciously pointed words in the contemporary scene. She diagnoses a kind of zero-sum enforced competition between authors for the limited resources of public attention, the great irony being that public attention is precisely what poets have recently lost through an increasingly morbid self-absorption. For the most part, poets now write for each other, or being too many has rather disguised this fact by conjuring the simulacrum of a real readership. But what Riley proposes isn't some kind of self-conscious reorientation towards the general reader, but something much more trusting, a return to what we might call the real work of the poet in all its traditionally out-of-time, unhurried and solitary contemplation. Poets were habitually distinguished not by their fascinating identity, but their singular talent, talents often protected by far more quiet, solitary, odd and distracted dispositions than the current competitive frenzy, the authenticity wars maybe, accommodates or favours.